Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 127 for November 17, 2011. A peek inside the Peterson. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us this Thursday for AutoLine After Hours. We're doing something a little bit different. We had to come into L.A. for the L.A. Auto Show, and we thought, as long as we're in Los Angeles, why don't we do AutoLine After Hours here? Unfortunately, my co-pilot, Peter DeLorenzo, is not with us tonight, so I can't wait to get back to be with Peter again. But speaking of Peter, we're at the Peterson Automotive Museum, one of the best museums in the world. Come on inside. We're going to take you on a walking tour. We're going to have some great conversation here, and we'll get into the rapid-fire part of the show as we always do at the end. But right now, come on in. Let's go inside the Peterson. Okay, first thing that we got to do is talk about the car that they've got in the lobby right here. This is the Edsel Ford Roadster. It's something that Edsel Ford, son of Henry Ford, built for himself. He had his designers craft this thing. It's a beautiful roadster, and it had sort of disappeared for a while. They found it. They got it kind of restored, but it was this kind of fire engine red paint job that they did to it. Now it's got this beautiful charcoal gray look to it, and it's just a spectacular automobile, extremely rare. And it's just really cool that it's the first thing that they have here in the museum. We're talking about it right now because they're actually going to move it from the museum to the LA Auto Show. And if we save it for later in the show to talk about, this thing will probably not be here. But just a very elegant car, clean, simple design, boat tail shape to it. I'm just really in awe of this car. It was built in 1934, and like I said, it was only very recently, like in the last year or so, that it was restored to this condition. Really good. But enough of what's in the lobby here. We got to talk with the curator of the museum, hey, Leslie Kendall. Leslie, it's so great to have you here on AutoLine After Hours with us today.
It's wonderful to have you. I'm glad you came.
Yeah. Well, look, let's go on a tour here, show everybody, you know, some of the highlights. We can't get into it all. There's just too much to see in the museum here.
I think if people understand that the Peterson Museum shows cars in a different way, we don't just line them up. We give them context, we put them in dioramas, and so people can understand how cars interacted with their surroundings. People can see a car that's stuck in the mud, that has to be manhandled out.
And, of course, we're looking at a very early American
car. This is an American car. This is actually called American. It's a 1911 American Underslung. Really, really large wheels and a frame that actually hung under the wheels, which is why they needed to be so big to get back that ground clearance.
But I love, like you say, you've got this diorama of it stuck in the mud, which, of course, was a very common occurrence back in its day.
There were not paved roads everywhere. there most certainly were not. And there weren't car manufacturers everywhere. Sometimes you had to make your own.
In fact, that's some of the banging and clanging that we hear in the background as you got this beautiful old barn jam-packed with all kinds of tools. It looks more like a blacksmith's shop.
Well, that's because what it is. It's a blacksmith shop. And, you know, that's where that's the first people that made cars a lot of times.
And what's the car? You've got a quadricycle kind of vehicle with a tiller steering to it. What is this?
It's a great description for it. It's actually a 1900 Breer.
Whoa.
Built by Carl Breer, a gentleman that ended up working for Chrysler and becoming very, very influential in their engineering department. But this is a steam car he built in his youth.
Wow.
It still runs. It's really extraordinary.
Even more impressive.
Yeah.
And I like what you're doing here, putting things in context. Like you say, it's not just cars on a carpet.
Right. You could go to any museum and see that, but we want to show people how cars interact.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, being in Los Angeles, there's a heavy California influence to everything that you're exhibiting here.
You're absolutely right. We talk a lot about L.A. That's where we are. This is the capital of car culture. Detroit may be the capital of car production, but we're the capital of car consumption.
It's true. It is true.
And there used to be a lot of racetracks in L.A. when land wasn't as valuable as it is today. And about the only way they could get a reliably smooth surface was to make it out of wood.
And so we're looking at a diorama right now of a Stutz Bearcat, is this? No.
They call it a white squadron racer, obviously, because of the color. But this car, it uses a very unique engine. It's very, very advanced for the day. And what wasn't so advanced was the surface on which it ran. Again, just boards
right.
put together.
And these were oval tracks.
There were oval tracks. Some were circular. But they all were eventually got saturated with grease, and sometimes the boards would pop loose and come up and injure drivers, and sometimes they would just catch on fire. And then they figured out a way to get a banked surface without having to resort to wood.
Good thing, because it's a bad day when your racetrack burns down.
You're not having a good day if that happens. Not having a good day. And kind of a break from the chronology.
As we walk through the museum here and look at different displays,
is this section here. We've got about 30 different dioramas on the first floor, and this is the first of three that don't really relate chronologically, but we want to show things that people can see that are interesting and that help you with the rest of the context. And right now we've got three home-built two-seater sports cars.
And you say home-built, but, man, these things are beautifully turned out.
They are. And that just gives you an idea of the creativity and the passion that these people brought to their everything that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have high school kids working on cars using brand-new fiberglass material. You've got a race car driver who designed the chassis with chalk on the garage floor.
Yeah, and we're talking about cars that were built 60 years ago or better.
Yes.
So when you mentioned fiberglass, that would have been, very exotic for its day.
Fiberglass was revolutionary. It's the early equivalent of carbon fiber today, only a lot less expensive and a lot easier to run.
Yeah, you don't need an autoclave to work in fiberglass.
No autoclave needed, just patience.
And here we're looking at another diorama with an early bungalow, right?
This is
a home.
It's somebody's house. It's really popular architectural style in Los Angeles
today, but this would have been very different back in the day.
See, we're putting people back in the 20s, and a lot of people built developments and things like that using this kind of style. The craftsman style, bungalow style became very, very popular. And what people were also starting to do was building garages so they could put the cars in, because cars were becoming really, really important. In L.A., then as now, you were nothing if you didn't have a car. If you couldn't get around, forget about it.
Right.
And the idea was to put your car in the garage, and that would protect it overnight. And here you've got a giant billboard, because people, they're going faster and faster. Cars are getting more and more powerful. Roads are getting better. So you want people to catch people's eye as they go by.
So you have to have gigantic billboards. So this would have never been in place in the 19th century, would it? No. This is a 20th century development.
Like not along a road.
And it's because you're going fast. I never thought of that before.
Because you're going fast. And also because you're going fast, you got to worry about this guy.
Yeah. And what Leslie's referring to is they've got, as part of this diorama, California Highway Patrolman in what, a 1930-ish something, Harley Davidson?
You got it. It's a 1932 Harley. We have a California Highway Patrol, very, very early bike, perfectly restored and correctly restored. It's very unusual to find one like this. And you've got this Highway Patrolman, this accurate mannequin, looking around the billboard, just waiting for you to come by, going a little too fast. And then I guess it's 30 days or $30. And then we walk down the street some more, and on our right we've got a gas station from the 1930s and marvelous Spanish architecture, which just suited the day so perfectly. And also, if you look on the other side, if you look to your left as you're walking, we have Powell Motor Company. And this is a diorama of a life-size car dealership of the 30s or 40s. Right now we feature a 1941 Cadillac, but this can be anything. When we opened, it was Auburn and Cord, and who knows what it'll be next. It's been 30 or 40 different things.
So you want to capture the flavor of what it was like shopping for a car back in the 30s and 40s.
Exactly. We want to show people that it was really like walking into a salon. It was an experience to celebrate. There were fine draperies, there were fine fabrics. You walked on Persian rugs a lot of times, and it was a really big event when you went in to buy a car.
It's interesting because, all the high-end marks today have very elaborate dealerships. So, I mean, this is nothing new,
This is nothing new. I think maybe they're even partially inspired by something like this.
Oh, they've got to be, sure. Because when you're dealing with a higher-end clientele, it's the whole shopping experience, right?
And when you were selling 19... 19- 41 Cadillacs, they were a lot of money. Even in 1941, they were always a luxury car, always very important.
Right.
And for the same reason, this is a little diversion, for the same reason that we had a billboard is the reason that we have this guy.
Now, describe this. What are we looking at here?
This is the Dog Diner.
Now, what we should tell everybody is we're looking at a gigantic-sized dog, a bulldog, with a pipe in his mouth with smoke coming out of the pipe, and he's got to be, what, 20, 30 feet tall
Probably
or something like that?
20 feet tall, at least. And he's got a pipe coming out of his mouth with live smoke, like you just said.
But it's a building.
And between his feet is a door you can walk through. And you can get ice cream, you can get a tamale. And the whole idea, just like the billboard, is you have to capture people's attention. And Southern California had an unusually large number of this kind of mimetic architecture and kind of became known for that.
And mimetic being that it mimics something. In this case, it mimics a dog.
Exactly. It mimics something in life. It could be a dog. It could be any giant tea kettle, you name it.
And we've seen, like motels. We've all seen the pictures of the teepees,
exactly.
Where you could go and stay in a teepee. And you got to believe that kids were telling their dad, stop. I want to get ice cream in the dog.
You know it. And anything to get a leg up, anything to get attention, mm-hmm. was what you needed.
Uh-huh.
What we have here is something that people think that strip malls are a modern invention. Well, they're not. They came about in the 1930s. The idea of a strip mall, before, the storefront was right along the sidewalk. And they figured that was enough. It was when you're walking by, you had a horse or something, that was not a problem. But what the strip mall did was they took the building and they moved it back on the property and they gave what used to be the most expensive land over to the car. Because they reasoned that if you couldn't accommodate customers traveling by car, you weren't going to have any customers and no business.
So the first strip mall actually started in California.
The very first strip mall is in California, and it is a walking distance from the Peterson Museum. It is still there. It's not a strip mall. Appropriately enough, it's a Porsche dealer.
That's unbelievable that the original strip mall is now a car dealership.
It's so perfect for L.A. What could be more L.A.?
Right.
What could be more L.A.? And then you end up, we take people, again, through the chronology of automobile development and the development of Los Angeles, we get into the post-war era.
Mm-hmm.
And people have to remember that there are an awful lot of returning servicemen coming back from Europe and elsewhere with a lot of new experiences. They have a lot of new skills, and they're anxious to put those skills to use improving their cars. They improve them for performance and by building hot rods, or they improve them for appearance by building customs. And we mm-hmm. have examples of a hot rod shop. We have example of a customizing shop. We also have an example, pretty high-profile example, of a drive-up diner. Exactly the kind of 1950s Jetson-like Googie architecture. Lots of spans of glass, colorful interior, lights were always on. And it was, again, it was attracting your attention. Look at all these people in here eating this great food, having a great time. It's warm, it's comfortable, or on a hot day, it's cool and comfortable. And it just becomes very, very inviting. And it became, again, a uniquely Southern California. The design was propagated all over the United States.
Mm-hmm. And I love how it looks so retro in the picture there, and yet in its day it must have been very modern.
That was as modern as tomorrow. In the 1950s, it was like the Jetson mobile landed.
I mean, there's so much that we can talk about here. We can only hit some of the highlights. There's all kinds of dioramas, all kinds of cars, and things related to cars that we're walking by right now that I just think is really helps put the car into context, as you mentioned before.
We want to tell the full story. We want to talk about the car. We want to talk about design in Los Angeles, how most of what's important today comes from L.A. Most of the designs come from people at, for example, Art Center College of Design.
Right, which is
going to work for the major car companies.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about safety.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fun, but you have to be a little bit realistic about it.
Right.
We also talk about the future of the automobile. We're not exactly sure what the future is going to be. It could be a solar-powered car like this goofy thing.
Yeah.
Or it could be anything. But
right. And when he says this goofy thing, it's a solar-powered car with these gigantic, so it almost looks like a hood or a bonnet or something on the top of the car.
It's like a car that carries around its own...
Covered in photovoltaic cells.
It's like it carries around its own tunnel.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was this is actually a hybrid. It is a solar-electric wind-powered hybrid because that's a sail. The idea was that the wind would help move you along.
Oh,
so
my
God. So on a dark
God.
Day that there was no breeze, you were in trouble.
Yes.
But on a sunny day with a good stiff wind, you could really make tracks.
Unbelievable. And it's this very bullet-shaped kind of vehicle, very, you know, almost looks like a land speed racer with this big wraparound of photovoltaics on it.
Well, the idea behind these solar-powered cars was to get them as lightweight as possible and as aerodynamic as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to lengthen the front and reduce the frontal area as much as possible.
Hey, there's an escalator right here. Let's jump on this because I know you got some good things upstairs.
Yeah,
and we can only hit one of the highlights of that because there's just so much to see here.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about the building is even historical. The building even relates to cars because it's at the very end of the world's first linear shopping district, which actually was designed around the automobile. This Wilshire Boulevard wouldn't have its current shape if it wasn't for the car.
Because everything had to be built around providing access for people,
exactly,
and parking, especially,
exactly,
right?
Parking was around the back. You found a store you wanted to go in,
mm-hmm.
you went around the back, and you parked.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking, what would be the best here? Maybe, should we go look at the scooters that you've got here? Because, yeah, why don't we go that way? Because,
yeah, let's look at the scooters.
I mean, there's just so much to look at here. Scooters and motorcycles.
We've got scooters, we've got motorcycles, we have alternative powers, supercars, you name it. We try to cover everything. There's an awful lot of stories.
Anything that's
to tell.
Motorized
that's
transportation?
Motorized. Anything that's important to the motoring landscape in Los Angeles. But a lot of people today find the scooters are about the most viable solution to their transportation problems. They're really inexpensive. They're fairly cheap to insure. They use very, very little gas. And they're very chic.
Yeah.
It's very chic now to ride a scooter.
And you can park them just about anywhere,
too. Park them anywhere. You can bring them in the house if you needed to, if you really needed to.
And what's amazing as I gaze around this exhibit that you've got here is the unbelievable variety of colors and shapes and forms.
It's just extraordinary what you can do with two little wheels and a tiny engine. It's utterly amazing, and it shows the inventiveness at work. You know, people, there's so many solutions to these problems.
I want to bore in on one of them because this blows me away. This has got to be the first scooter, more or less. 1917 is what this says.
Exactly right. This is a 1917 scooter. These were actually introduced in 1915 and is the world's first practical scooter. It has two tiny little wheels. It's got a platform on which you stand. Later, they were available with seats. You push the handlebar forward to go. You pull it back to stop. And the engine is actually built integrally with the front hub.
Unreal.
Very interesting way to do it. It's a nice, compact assembly.
And it says that it's an autoped. Is that what they called those things?
They were called autopeds. Yep. Exactly.
When did the term scooter come around, you know?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think anybody knows exactly, but the scooters were derived from children's toys, and they called those scooters.
Mm-hmm.
So the push-kick toys.
Uh-huh.
And scooters share, modern scooters, even back to 17, they share an awful lot of architecture with the children's toys.
Unbelievable variety here, too. Here's another one that I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. It looks like a military scooter from World War II.
Well, you've got a good eye, because that's exactly what it is. This is called a Cushman Airborne. The idea with this scooter was to drop it by parachute from an airplane so that the GIs on the ground would have something to scoot around in. And frankly, not many of these survived because when you were done getting to where you needed to go, you just left it. You weren't worried about this. You were worried about the enemy and getting to someplace safe and taking care of business.
How do you put a collection like this together? Because, again, if you don't see this, you can't appreciate the tremendous amount of variety of styles and different kinds of scooters there are here.
Well, we have a couple of approaches. We like to show people what they expect to see. When somebody comes to see a scooter exhibit, they're expecting to see Vespas.
Yeah.
They're expecting
right.
to see Lambrettas.
That's what I thought
they're
I would see here.
They're expecting to see Cushmans. But we also want to show people that, yeah, there are those things, but there's really interesting varieties of those things, like the postal van. Right
oh, my
here,
gosh. Oh, my gosh. Right.
Based on a Lambretta. But there are also really kooky things, like Harley Davidson made a scooter called the Topper. There was a company that made a scooter that was just for carrying golf clubs. You could have scooters that folded up.
And here's one that fits in a suitcase,
And here's
too.
One that fits in the suitcase, the world's smallest scooter. You fold up the handlebars, you fold up the foot pegs, you put it in your suitcase. I think you'd have trouble getting it through through
security these days at the airport. That's right.
Now, but back then, I don't think
I'm sure they see a lot of weird things. I'll bet they've never seen that.
My hunch is they never have, right. And probably won't for some time.
So again, how do you go about collecting these things? How do you even know what to collect? How do you go out and find them?
Well, we keep an active list of people who offer things to us. There are a lot of collectors in Los Angeles. Because remember, L.A., you can drive cars year-round. So people have cars, and they do drive them year-round, and they have garages full of them. It's wonderful how many collectors are here. And sometimes we have to go to other parts of the country. But people, you know, very freely.
Pretty much you can find what you need here, huh?
Yeah, we've got a wonderful collection of our own. We have a collection of about 350 vehicles. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these scooters are from our own collection. But those that aren't, we borrowed. Like this example, this is a wonderful example. This is actually the only case that I know of where a vehicle came as an optional extra for another vehicle. This was never sold in America, but it was sold.
We're looking at what, a Honda?
We're looking at a Honda City. It's called a Honda City. And it looks like a Civic that somebody left in the dryer too long because it's very, very small. But it comes with a tiny fold-up, what they call a moto compo, but it's really a scooter in the back.
And you flip
up the hatch, you pull out the scooter, you unfold it, you get on it, and you drive away.
What year is this, more or less?
This is the early 80s. And what you do, went as far as you could with the car, and then once you reach the limit, you got in your scooter, and went the rest of the distance.
That's pretty wild. I remember seeing pictures of that, but I've never actually seen one before.
Yeah. Well, you won't. This is probably the only one in America.
Wow.
They're very, very rare in America because they're very popular in Japan and other areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only do we talk about the chronology of scooters, but, you know, we are L.A.-centric. We like to talk about what's been going on in our own backyard. And scooters are a really important part of Los Angeles manufacturing history. There are so many scooters.
I had no idea. I never knew that.
Most people don't. A lot of them, you had Powell, you had Salisbury, you had Motor Glide, you had all different kinds of things. And variations, too. Like I had these kooky delivery vehicles.
And these are all, what, 1940s-ish?
Yeah, this car here is a 1950. They call it a car. It's a tri-car, which is Salisbury's delivery vehicle. And you've got these bad boys right here, the Salisbury Model 85 Deluxe and the Model 85 Regular. This is kind of the holy grail for scooter aficionados because they're so sleek. They're so futuristic looking.
Futuristic in an Art Deco kind of a way.
In an Art Deco way. And they're impossibly orange. So pictures.
Yes, they are.
If you have a scooter that has a full fairing on it, the engine fully enclosed in sheet metal, and you've got what amounts to a chair to sit on. It's actually a pretty comfortable way to go.
And they're really cool looking. You almost wonder why nobody's revived this kind of approach to doing a scooter.
They may yet. People, you know what? People seem to borrow inspiration from every generation. And who knows? Maybe somebody will turn back and say, you know what? That sounds very pretty cool. Maybe we should try that again.
Yeah, no doubt.
We talk about also, just to wrap it up, we talk about Vespas, which, you know, you can't have a scooter exhibit and not focus in on Vespas.
We have an
entire section just devoted to Vespa. We have a Vespa Woody. Most people have no idea was out there. But they were actually marketed in America as an alternative to station wagon.
And it's really like a comfortable seat that would seat at least two people very comfortably with a wood body around it and a fabric cover to it.
Yeah, and a big old fabric canopy, and it looks like a little motorized rickshaw.
It does.
In a way. Painted kind of a pale metallic green. It's very, very rare.
I was going to say, I mean, to me, my mind would say this is something that you would see in India or something like that, but it's from here.
Well, they tried everything in America. They tried, you know, even the Soviet Union in the 50s tried to market cars in America. They thought, well, this is where the money is. Why not try to get some of it? So that's what they did.
Get your money from the capitalists, of course.
That's right.
We got to take a look at this.
Be sure to point this out. Yes.
You've got Hot Wheels. You've got all kinds of Hot Wheel cars,
all
toys.
Kinds of Hot Wheel cars. We have toys. And we show kids that, you know, Hot Wheels, they come from someplace. They have to be designed. They have to be built. Fortunately, the designers don't have to worry too much about ergonomics and things because nobody's going to get into them. But it's interesting for kids to see where their little toys come from, to see that they are engineered and they are designed, and that maybe when they grow up, they can help design them.
And you've got to add, designed here in Los Angeles.
Designed here in Los Angeles. The most popular manufacturer in the world of cars is based right here in L.A. It's called Mattel.
See, that's pretty cool. Again, I mean, I knew, of course, that these cars had to be designed and all that. I had no idea the Hot Wheels cars were done in L.A.
Absolutely right. Designed right here in Los Angeles. Again, this is where a lot of the inspiration is. It's mm-hmm. a lot of the customs are here. This is where you see these things on the street more than anywhere else. Very unusual to see a custom in, for example, Chicago or someplace, mm-hmm. especially this time of year.
Right. So, Leslie, how do you come up with ideas of what you want in the museum and how you want to exhibit them?
Well, we look at our mission, which is to explore and present the history of the automobile and its impact on our life and culture with an emphasis on Los Angeles. So anything that overlaps into that is what we want to talk about. We mm-hmm. want to talk about, of course, racing. And we have a whole corridor of the museum devoted to racing and performance. We've got the Bruce Meyer Gallery, which is normally devoted to hot rods, but right now it has a special exhibition on Phil Hill.
Because Phil Hill just passed away in the
Phil
last
Hill
year.
Phil Hill passed away not too long ago, but it's also the 50th anniversary of his championship season.
Mm-hmm.
The world's America's first world champion. And we've got a lot of the cars that he drove. Ferrari GTO, nice, beautiful blue Ferrari GTO, a gigantic white Ferrari 375 Mille Miglia, and an impossibly red Ferrari Testarossa, all cars that Phil Hill had considerable racing success with, and all that are so much more valuable for him having ridden in them,
mm-hmm.
driven
and,
them.
And a Chaparral Can-Am car, too, way
and
there and back.
Chaparral Can-Am way in the back.
And I guess, you know, I'd forgotten that. Phil Hill had driven for Chaparral, too.
He did. One of his last races was in a Chaparral. And Chaparral is so notable as if you could just picture that giant wing on the back.
Mm-hmm. Movable wing, right?
It generated lots of downforce. It enabled him to go around the corners really, really quickly. Where other people were sliding around, he was sticking to the road.
Yeah, because they used that wing as an air brake, not just for downforce, but as an air brake going
right,
into turns.
And you had a supplemental air brake in the front, too, that was operated with your feet.
Mm-hmm. And here we're walking into an area tagged supercars, and, of course, that's so L.A. as well.
This is L.A. There's no way you're going to approach you're going to be able to use a supercar the way it's designed to be used, but just the fact that you look like you can do that is enough for
right.
enough for a lot of people. And we define supercars as anything that's too much. It's just got too much power. It's got too much style. It's way too expensive. It embodies every ideal of an automobile. And the fact that you never see them, or very unusual, that they're very unusual is makes them all the more desirable.
And you got all kinds of things here. Lamborghini Miura, Pantera, De Tomaso Pantera, a Countach Lamborghini, all kinds of Mercedes and Porsches. Who owns these cars? Does the museum or do you get them on loan?
Well, the museum owns quite a few of these cars, but the rest are on loan from private collectors
mm-hmm.
in the area.
What do you in terms of the cars? Do you sell them eventually? Or, I mean, I imagine it's got to be real hard to determine what you want to buy, what you want to keep, what you want to sell, what you want to borrow.
It's actually not that difficult because we have a list of hot things we'd like to get should they become available, you know, under the right circumstances. But we take donations. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, so people give us a vehicle, they can take it off their tax returns,
mm-hmm.
and it works for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been getting some wonderful gifts that way. Just some marvelous gifts. And Mr. and Mrs. Peterson have been incredibly generous
mm-hmm.
with us. So Mr. Peterson, during his lifetime, acquired 120, 130 cars, and including this marvelous Mercedes.
So, and just real quickly, who was Mr. Peterson and why did he do the museum?
Mr. Peterson founded Hot Rod Magazine. He founded Motor Trend Magazine.
Built a whole publishing empire.
Built a publishing empire. He was a local guy, and he wanted to give back. He wanted to celebrate the automobile, celebrate automotive culture that he actually helped create.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, we got to wrap this segment of the show up, Leslie, but I want you to come back when we do the rapid-fire segment where we take questions from the audience. So don't disappear.
I will. I'd love to.
We're going to need you here in a minute, but right now we've got to take a commercial break. The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm, and a key reason is all the equipment that it offers.
a driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStart, turn-by-turn directions, free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise.
Look at this. Bridgestone's using natural rubber, researching ways to enhance its quality and performance, and making their factories more environmentally friendly, producing products that save on fuel and emissions, and some that can be reused again, and promoting eco-friendly and safety driving campaigns. One team, one planet. Bridgestone.
Hyundai is known for the great value that it offers, but let's not forget about the technology. The Hyundai Sonata is the first vehicle in its segment with standard integrated Bluetooth hands-free phone. It's the first vehicle in its segment with factory-installed HD radio technology with multicasting. And it's the first vehicle in its segment with XM Nav traffic and XM data services. That, plus NHTSA's 5-star overall crash test rating and the IIHS top safety pick, explain why the Sonata is selling so well. And you can check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com.
Right now, we're back down in the main lobby of the Peterson Museum, looking once again at the 1934 Edsel Ford Roadster. Joining me right now is John Kleiner, formerly of Ford Motor Company, right? You're retired now,
how do we describe you? Well, I'm sort of I guess you call it a Ford lifer. I was with Ford for a little over 38 years, retired January 1st, came back to work January 3rd on contract in the same office. So I just love Ford, and I'm so excited that this car is still here to talk a bit about it.
And I know they want to haul this away to the LA Auto Show, so let's talk a little bit about this in more detail, and then let's sit down and chat about some other things.
Terrific.
But what a stunning looking car.
It's incredible. Edsel Ford, the original Edsel Ford, the son of Henry Ford, was an artist. His talents were in art and photography. He traveled to Europe a great deal. His European tastes were very much reflected in this car. This is a car that he commissioned Bob Gregory, E.T. Bob Gregory, to lead the design of. It is an aluminum body. The interesting thing, these fenders are in fact modified from Ford Trimotor fenders. It was built in the Ford Trimotor plant in Michigan. Again, aluminum, same material they used to make the Trimotor aircraft. This is a car that he designed thinking, I'd like to produce this sort of car. It never came to pass. Too bad it didn't, but it's just recently been restored to its former glory, as we see here. Edsel Ford II found the car. It actually belongs to the Edsel and Eleanor Ford House in Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Which is even worth talking about in itself, because that house is a beautiful, almost English kind of cottage
on
a grand scale, because it is kind of a mansion, really.
Cotswold English,
But again, it reflects Edsel's tastes.
Exactly.
Whereas if you go to Henry Ford's, his father's house, it's kind of English castle-ish, a castle-like, and it's not inviting. Whereas Edsel's house, you just want to go in and be there. Because
he had the design flair, no question about it. And Edsel II has been the catalyst in bringing back a full collection of cars that Edsel I either designed and or owned to celebrate his grandfather's actually very prominent role in Ford Motor Company design.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. Edsel, even though you describe him as an artist and the like, he was a real car guy.
I mean, absolutely.
He understood car design and especially the aesthetics part of it.
In fact, Edsel Ford I bought the first MG ever sold in America.
That's amazing. I never knew that.
And he had a Bugatti in which they designed a custom golf bag carrier. So he loved cars from the other side of the pond, and it was reflected in some of the cars.
And I guess an Edsel Ford could get away with buying Bugattis and MGs and things like that,
whereas
it might be frowned on to these days.
Well, to their credit, the Ford family, they appreciate great cars.
Uh-huh.
And that's good because, lots of people make different great cars, and to have an awareness of what's out there is very helpful for Ford Motor Company.
Well, come on, walk with me. Let's go through
We're going to watch them through the vehicle.
Oh, Okay. They're telling me right now that they're actually going to fire this thing up to move it out of here. So we'll listen to that happen.
Not many people have witnessed this.
I've never witnessed
it. This car was unveiled at Pebble Beach.
And look how hard it is to climb into this thing. I mean, the steering wheel is so close to the seat. It's so awkward to get in there.
But Greg Stoner here from Ford is one of few people who are allowed to operate this vehicle. He came from Michigan for this purpose. It hasn't run for at least a month sitting here.
So he just pulled the choke out a bit.
Yeah.
Giving it some gas.
It will be going to the Los Angeles Auto Show.
There it goes.
For exhibit.
Whoa. So close. All right. Flathead V8. You can't mistake that sound anywhere.
Absolutely.
And it's great. We should say, you know, we've attracted a little crowd here in the museum. Yep. They're all watching us watch this car being moved. This thing just sounded fantastic.
Yes.
You know, as good as it sounds just idling or, you know, backing up slowly here, you can only imagine what it must have sounded like. You know, add a couple of thousand RPM to that exhaust note, it would really come alive.
Typical of a one-off custom car like this, the engine was massaged a bit as well. It's a very healthy flathead.
You know, it's also interesting. Look how much he's moving the steering wheel without the tires moving a whole lot. I mean, lock to lock must be 100 turns.
This is state-of-the-art 1934, exactly. Well, this is a rare treat for these people to see the car being driven, because very few people have seen the car at all, let alone being driven.
Well, and what is the guy's name you said that's driving?
Greg Stoner.
Well, kudos to Greg for getting it started and for not stalling it either.
Absolutely. He's the Iceman when it comes to moving precious cars. He moves Ford concept cars all over the world. And for the really special ones like this, he personally is the one who does it. So I told him he should write a book someday.
He really should.
He's
got
a lot of stories, I'm sure.
No doubt about it. And then to have to ship those cars around the world because they're styling reviews and different parts of Ford.
Cars to auto shows. And, concept cars, that sort of thing. Yes.
Well, let's go back inside the museum here, out of the lobby area where we've got all kinds of people. But one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is you started something that is, or helped start, Cars and Coffee.
Well, yes, I guess I helped continue something is probably the best way to put it. And Freeman Thomas, Ford design chief in Irvine, deserves equal credit for that.
Uh-huh.
Cars and Coffee, yes.
Which is a very LA thing.
Well, it is, yeah. In fact, it's interesting, this tour you've had of the museum here, talking about the car culture in LA, it said, it can be argued forever, but it said that Detroit is the auto industry capital, L.A. is the auto enthusiast capital.
Yeah. And I would just say it's the center of the universe of automotive culture.
Well, yep. A lot of people would agree with that, certainly.
Yeah, and that's a Detroit guy saying that.
Well, in fact, I'm a Detroit guy as well, and I was very fortunate.
But you spent most of your career out here,
well,
right?
Well, a good half of it. I moved here in 1988 on a two-year assignment, and here I am. So, and I was actually here for the opening of the Peterson Museum, which was a great privilege. At the time, I didn't dream I would still be here and able to have this walkthrough today. But Cars and Coffee is if anything, it's a California thing, but it has now spread all around the world, the concept. And it's simply an impromptu calendarized get-together of car enthusiasts with interesting cars.
And by calendarized, you mean Saturday morning?
Yes. In our case, it's every Saturday. There are Cars and Coffee events in other parts of the world which have simply copied our idea. We're in no way affiliated with them. On behalf of Ford Motor Company, I host with my wife the Saturday morning Irvine Cars and Coffee. We get 400 to 600 cars every Saturday.
That's amazing.
And the turnover is only, I will tell you, I see at least 40 cars every Saturday that I've never seen before.
That's so astonishing.
Just, yeah, and this has been going on for now a little over 5 years. So
the whole idea is get a cup of coffee and walk around the parking lot
right,
and look at these cars.
Right, right.
Here, have a seat in the chair here.
Terrific.
Let's take a load off our minds here.
All right, great. So actually, in about 2003, two fellows copied an idea that's been going for about 20 years in Huntington Beach called Donut Derelicts, uh-huh. which...
Another very L.A. kind
yes,
of a thing.
Yes, Donut Derelicts, that's the real hardcore guys. They get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, their own site at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you show up at 6 a.m., they say, hey, good afternoon. But this is a group of mostly hot rodders, such as this hot rod shop we're in here. Some fellows who lived in Newport Beach said, oh, that's a long way to drive. We don't want to get up quite that early. Let's start something ourselves. So in 2003, they started their own informal gathering at a strip mall, funny thing, strip mall, called Crystal Cove. It's just south of Newport Beach. And it was a low-key, strictly word-of-mouth thing. And 50 cars came, and 80 cars came, and before you know it, it was 150 cars. And that was okay. It was containable. But then, instantly, the Orange County Register ran a newspaper article about it in 2005, and the world came. Suddenly, it was discovered, and they were just inundated. So the property owners reluctantly said, you got to go somewhere else. We just can't handle this. Freeman Thomas and I happened to be on hand that day, and we thought, well, we've got a spot. So, in fact, we invited Dan Gurney, Reeves Calloway, Barry McGuire, a few other fellows who were there to come over and look at the Ford parking lot in Irvine at our building. And it's actually the lot that's shared between Ford and Mazda, and Mazda gets kudos for agreeing with this as well. Uh-huh. So we invited people to come over. We actually printed up flyers and said, okay, guys, you got to go somewhere. We've got the somewhere. Come over to Irvine. And the first Saturday, which was in late October 2006, we had a little over 300 cars show up, and it's just never stopped from that day forward. So it's a word-of-mouth thing. We don't have a website. We try to keep it pretty low-key, because if we allowed, for example, a newspaper locally to cover it, we'd have the same problem. And I have an agreement with all the local media, they will not cover it.
Is that right?
Yep, and they're very good. They can come. We have Chris Woodruff from USA Today. We'll have writers from LA Times. We'll have reporters from local TV come. And what they'll do is pick individuals and do stories about those individuals. But the agreement is you'll never mention Irvine. You'll never mention Cars and Coffee. Just keep it, help us keep it under the radar. And even with that effort, we still get some Saturdays where people are lined up. And we have room for maximum 600 cars on the property, and we'll fill it with
Unreal.
That.
And
plus, we have spectator cars, so we get 2,000 people there uh-huh. mostly every Saturday. We tell people this event is about cars you won't see the other 6 days of the week. That's the criteria. So, you know, if you're driving a new BMW with tinted windows, that's nice, but please go park in spectator. We want cars that really make people want to get out of bed and see in the morning. So it's anything that's exotic, nostalgic, whimsical, bizarre. We had the Deathmobile from Animal House show up. That was great. And Ford Motor Company has supported this. And much to his credit, Ray Day, our vice president, he said, yep, I like this idea. We will pay to have the Irvine Police Department on hand. And
even
that allows us to do it.
Most of the cars are not Fords.
True. It's everything. Lots of Fords are there, but lots of everything is there. Uh-huh. It's unbelievable.
So kudos to Ford to support stuff that
absolutely.
Is actually supporting
absolutely.
Competing brands.
And honestly, yeah. And our thought is, you know, we're car people. And anybody who is car people, you know, will come to this. And yeah, through osmosis, they're going to say, you know, we like Ford. In fact, I had an instance not too long ago where a man was driving out in his 911 Porsche. I said, thanks for coming. He said, you know, I got to tell you, my daughter is in college. I was going to buy her Toyota. I canceled the order and doing this. So that was
that
great.
Paid off.
That's okay. But back to the Irvine Police, when the Deathmobile drove in, this is that wacky car from Animal House, has a Chariot. It's a modified old Lincoln. The motorcycle cop just looked at the thing and just shook his head. Let him go. So there's a great, in fact, the police are, there's a waiting list for them wanting to come and do this duty, because it's not part duty. You just, you know, the main thing is for them, just by being there, it means that people will be careful in departing. Pedestrian safety is our main concern.
Because you have a lot of high-performance cars that show up
absolutely.
For this, and everybody
absolutely.
Would just like to blow out of there.
Right, sure. There's that natural tendency, but it doesn't happen, and we've now been a little over 5 years with complete harmony and success. And again, our neighbors at Mazda are very supportive of it, and it's just a good time.
So when people just show up, or do you invite cars to be there, or how do you determine what goes in the public viewing area as opposed to the public parking area?
The small lot that is assigned to the design center as opposed to the main lot, the small lot holds about 50 cars, and that we call our featured mark lot. And from time, about once a month, we will feature something. And the way that happens is, for example, a club president for the Porsche Club or whatever, they will call me and say, can I have such and such a date? So, yeah, fine. And the agreement is that they don't tell anybody. They just tell the guys who are bringing cars. Because, again, we want it to all be low-key for total attendance, as well as we want it to be a complete surprise. So every Saturday, people keep coming back and again because every Saturday is something new. So it's just the surprise factor of it is really good. So the formula has worked very well. By keeping it low-key, by not having a website, honestly, by having police presence, those are the key things. I've received calls from people from all over the world saying, how do you do it? And those are the things I tell them. You have to do this. And having a corporate venue, which Ford has kindly provided, sure helps as well. Mm-hmm. Where we are is away from population areas. There's no residential presence. There's an interstate right beside us. So it makes a nice spot for doing all of this. So.
Clearly, you're a car guy. What do you have?
Oh, gosh.
I love your response. It's almost one of melancholy. Now I have to explain it all.
Well, the main thing I have is a very supportive wife, Linda. In fact, we call her the Walmart greeter for Cars and Coffee. She's there every Saturday with me, and with her school teacher demeanor, she's very good at saying, you know, your car should go over and inspect there. Okay, and I'll go park and inspect there. She and I went to a racer driver school on our honeymoon. She's a car woman, car
all
guy.
Right. You married well.
So in 1976, when she was a school teacher in Plymouth, Michigan, and I was working for Ford, my annual salary is $14,000. Her annual salary is $13,000. A friend of ours offered us a 1958 Ferrari 250 Cabriolet, Series 1 Cabriolet, for $13,000. So, gosh, are we going to spend your entire annual income? Yeah, let's do it. We had no children, no, you know, so forth.
So, you were young.
That's right.
So we bought a 250 Ferrari for $13,000?
That was all the money in 1976. And fortunately, we still have the car. So, yeah.
Wow.
So it's...
How cool is that? And it runs great and everything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it runs great. Yeah. And in fact, actually, at the moment, it's in the Ford Design Studio in Irvine as one of the reference vehicles being looked at for a new Ford product that they're developing. So that's kind of cool.
Wait a minute. I love this story.
Well, in fact, at that studio, it's interesting. One of the benefits of Cars and Coffee, for example, the Ford Start concept car that Freeman and his staff developed. It's a beautiful, just endearing, roundish little car, concept car. It was debuted at the Beijing Auto Show. Freeman had, for reference, three cars from Cars and Coffee attendees, a 61 Alfa Romeo Giulietta Sprint Zagato, a Deutsche Bonnet, a French car, and a 57 Porsche Speedster. All of those had that roundish theme to them, and they were used as reference cars. So Freeman has, from Cars and Coffee, just an endless supply of reference vehicles that he can bring in to help with the process. So it works very nicely.
That's pretty cool, and it's got to really mean something for the owner of those cars to be tapped on the shoulder by Freeman Thomas and say, you know, I'd like to put that in my studio for a while.
Right.
That's got to be one of the coolest things to happen.
Yeah, it is. It's and just the goodwill and the, you know, car people is the great equalizer. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, young or old. If you love cars, you love cars, and you kind of love each other. And that's the dynamic that we have every Saturday morning with people bringing everything from brand new Bugatti, like the supercar exhibit we saw upstairs. Last week, I was allowed to drive for the first time, I'll call it a real Fiat 500, 1969 Fiat 500, two-cylinder, 17 horsepower. I had a ball driving the thing around. And, you know, it doesn't matter. Everybody with something interesting is welcome.
That's right. You know, that's what I love about cars is whether it's some of the big monsters that we saw outside or a little Cinquecento, a two-cylinder, it's fun to drive.
Exactly.
You look at a car like that and you go, man, I want to get in there. I want to experience it.
3 weeks ago, to everyone's amazement, none of us knew the car was coming. In came a 50s era Mercedes-Benz tow truck, as you would find on the Autobahn, with all the German license plate and everything. And again, the police are good at looking the other way. If cars are authentic, that's fine. Well, he was carrying an 18 1997 Benz, a one-cylinder, this thing, in perfect condition. He rolled in, tilted the thing out, rolled this one-cylinder 1897 Benz off and drove it around the lot for people to see. You know, it's just amazing. So every Saturday we have an array of cars that would merit an annual spot on the calendar most anywhere else. It's pretty amazing.
And it's amazing that so many people own these vehicles in the LA area.
Right. And we have quite a number of, while we discourage local publicity because of crowd, we welcome, for example, like we're doing now, for people in Detroit to know about it. And internationally, we've had two occasions where tour buses have brought people. One was a group from Norway. They had been to the SEMA show. They said, let's go over to Cars and Coffee. A bus came up and unloaded 40 people, 40 Norwegians, to walk around and look at. They had heard about it. And another case, we had a group of Japanese and Thai visitors. So it's a lot of fun and a great, just a great celebration of the automobile that people share.
And every single week, right?
Yes,
or just about every single week.
No, we were there last year. It happened that a Saturday fell on Christmas morning and New Year's morning. We were there, and lots of other people were there. So it's every Saturday.
That's even more amazing.
Know, we've created this momentum that can't be stopped, so there you are.
Good for you guys. Hey, let's do the rapid-fire segment of the show right now. Let's get Leslie back in here, though we've got to monkey around with the microphones a little bit. And so give us a second here.
We're going to turn this one.
But Leslie, come on, take a seat and
Very good.
So usually we run this graphic and this whole soundtrack for Rapid Fire. We can't do that with the technology that we're using to strive to stream here live from the Peterson Museum. So we'll just start Rapid Fire. First question is from Miss Motormouth. She wants to know, John, are the pony car wars over? And if not, how many more horsepower can they legally add? Does anyone need 650 horsepower, which, of course, is a reference to the Shelby GT500 that was just unveiled at the LA Auto Show. 650 horsepower, 200-mile-an-hour capability, and yet it is not hit with a gas guzzler tax, which I find extraordinary.
It's amazing. It is amazing. Well, does anyone need 650 horsepower? With many cars that are on the road today, certainly at the LA Auto Show, do you need the car? Well, but do you want the car?
Yeah.
Sure, people want it. Does anyone need it? Well, it works very well in the chassis where it is applied. We wouldn't put 650 horsepower in the new Escape, but certainly on this Mustang, the Shelby, yes. I would call it part of the celebration of the automobile. There are all kinds of cars, you know, a few feet away from that Mustang is a Focus EV. So there's everything for everybody, and you know, that's the wonderful thing about cars. Think about the invention of the automobile, the freedom that it gives in every sense of the word that our ancestors just didn't have. They were in that blacksmith shop back there, you know, shoeing a horse.
That's right.
Talk about emissions, by the way. So, you know, sure, we need 650 horsepower.
Are the pony car wars over?
Oh, certainly not.
Yeah.
Certainly not.
I read it the exact same way. Okay, you're going to have to pass the microphone to Leslie, because
right.
Mitch W. wants to know, in a nutshell, what's the mission statement for the Peterson?
Real easy. It's the Peterson Museum exists to explore and present the history of the automobile and its impact on American life and culture using Los Angeles as its prime example.
That's great, and you must get visitors from all over the world, though, even though it's for Los Angeles.
Well, we're LA-centric, but that means that we're very ecumenical. We get an awful lot of people here. We cover everything. It's because LA is so accepting of car culture, so much happens here that's interesting, and we get to talk about all of it.
And I imagine you've got a whole lot more that's just not on an exhibit right now. You must have a pile of other cars and components and whatnot, too.
We have a number of cars that are in our reserve collection that we keep in the vault. But, you know, we also go into the community, you know, people that might come to Cars and Coffee, people that might go to other car shows and friends that we've made over the years. If we need a car, they'll loan it to us temporarily for an exhibition.
Okay, Jim wants to know, how is the Peterson funded and how many people visit a year on average?
We get about 150,000 to 160,000 people a year. We have active school bus program. We get a lot of students here, some researchers even. The Peterson Museum is funded in many ways, but primarily through admissions. We offer special events. The Peterson Museum is a special event space. And we do accept donations.
Are you listening, people? Are you listening out there in the audience?
We are a 501c3, and I would like to point that out.
We're tax deductible.
Okay. We're always looking for interesting things, and we love it when people tell us what they have.
Jesse W. Henry says, I wonder how many of those Cushmans are in barns in France and Germany.
I wonder, too. I'd love to find that. But, you know, one thing about those little scooters is you can put them in a corner and just forget about it because they're so small. You can stash them away. It's not like a gigantic car that you're going to keep tripping over. It's easy to forget about a Cushman. So I'm sure in some, you know, some French barn, there's probably quite a few.
Okay, Jay Cujo says, why does Peter not join you on the West Coast? Have they barred him from California because of his rants? That's exactly it. There's big signs at the airport with his picture on it with the X's through them. No, I'm just joking. No, Peter wasn't able to make it out for this trip. But so there you go, Jay Cujo. That's what happened there. Let's see. Tony Gray says, I wonder how often they exercise those museum cars.
Well, we try to exercise cars pretty regularly. 6 to 8 weeks is a good amount of time between
rides. Really? Everything that we walk around, you start them up and run?
Yeah. Some cars are set, not everything. Some cars are set up for long-term exhibition, which means we drain fluids and we put them on jack stands and things like that. Not to take away from the visitor's experience, but just to preserve the machine. But if it runs, when we get it, it stays running.
Just to mention, quite a lot of car shows, Concours d'Elegance events and others, the Peterson Museum, thanks very much to Leslie, is a regular participant in these events, and their cars add a great deal to, again, the love affair with the automobile here in California.
Well, think about it, because, you know, we talked about the Edsel.
The Speedster?
The Speedster. Yeah. It's one thing to talk about it, but when he started it up and it started rolling, it's like, wow.
Right.
It's that, you know, again, I get that urge. I want to be in that car. I want to go. So to have them out at concours or parades or things like that is fantastic because the public will then appreciate those cars on a different level.
Yes, it's living history.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. Let's see here. Mike DeWight says, speaking of Car of the Year, what's with the Passat being Motor Trend's Car of the Year? I don't know. You're going to have to ask Motor Trend about that. I didn't have any vote in that. I'm voting on the North American Car and Truck of the Year. We'll announce that at the Detroit Auto Show in January. Let's see. Comment from Carl from Fairfax. He says, Ford's been vague about the timing of the Focus ST U.S. launch. Rumor said as early as this fall. Well, we're past the fall. I mean, now Ford says coming late 2012. John, what can you tell us about the timing of when the ST hits the market here in the U.S.?
We have it on display at the L.A. Auto Show. The timing, I am not aware of, honestly, what that is. But it, obviously, the car does now exist, and it's on the way, so stay tuned.
Okay, Carl wants to know, too. Sounds like Europe's going to get the goods before we do.
Well, that's often been the case, but the great thing is we are getting the goods. There was a time not long ago when we just didn't. Uh-huh. So these cars being developed in Europe, yes, they're introduced there, but they're coming here with, in many cases, essentially no differentiation. And that's a big plus for, you know, you compare, for example, years back, people would go to Europe and drive cars and, you know, I got this great car from Hertz and I can't get it in the U.S. Those days are disappearing. Now we truly do have the same goodies on both sides of the ocean, which is terrific.
Well, and kudos to Ford for the one Ford kind of
Absolutely.
Way of approaching things, because
yes.
That's what makes it possible.
That's right.
And also at the LA show, they showed a Fiesta ST.
Yes.
That's a little bit of a surprise, because we've been hearing about the Focus ST.
Yeah,
all
that is, it is a concept, but it's not an idle concept.
No, it sure looks production ready to me.
Yeah.
Oh, here's an interesting thing. Elmer says, I wonder how much more body with fancy sheet metal costs compared to a simple one. He says, how many machines does it take to stamp a Sonata's door compared to a Corolla's? And how much more in dollar terms would that cost per door? You know, that's pretty interesting. Actually, as I've always said, it costs no more money to stamp out a beautiful body than an ugly one. And if you compare stampings to a Sonata and a Corolla, I'll bet they're very, very similar. Now, when you want to start talking in terms of depth of draw, like if you look at the rear three-quarter on today's Camaro, that's a very deep draw steel. So that's probably about a five die set draw, I would guess. Mm.
You know, whereas when you get into things like the Corolla and the Sonata, that's probably going to be 4 hits per panel, in some case 3 hits per panel.
Right.
So there can be some differences, but generally speaking, what I said is it costs no more to design a beautiful body than an ugly one.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
And let's see what else we've got here from the audience. And, you know, this is true. They're just coming in, so I'm reading them cold here. I haven't pre-read these things. Let's see. Jadzik says, over the last couple of weeks, Chevrolet has announced the new Colorado and Trailblazer. I understand the Colorado is being planned for the U.S. market and that possibly it will be built in Wentzville, Missouri. The word on the Trailblazer is that it will not be built for the U.S. market. What gives? Well, what gives is it's kind of like Ford with the Ranger, right? You have the Ford Ranger sold, very different truck than what we see in the U.S. market, sold elsewhere in the world. Will not be sold here. Why? Because you've got the F-Series trucks to take care of that. And I know people don't accept that the Ranger pickup really competes with the F-Series, but it would be kind of awkward, I guess, for Ford to put both in the showroom.
Well, when you look at the fuel economy now achievable with the F-Series, the difference that used to exist isn't there anymore. So it broadens the reach, you might say, of the F-Series.
And I guess I'm guessing it's the same sort of thing with the Trailblazer. It's built for an international market, not so much for the U.S. market. And Chevrolet is going to have a number of products that are close enough that they don't want to bring this international Trailblazer here. That's what I'm imagining it is. Yeah. Well, look, we've got a whole lot of other questions here, but we're also at the top of the hour of the show. So I think it's time to wrap it up. But John Kleiner from Ford, thanks so much for coming on, especially talking about cars and coffee.
Well, I want to say I've been a viewer of Autoline most every Thursday, and it's a real treat to be on this side of the camera. Thank you very much. It's just, you do a great job. It's a terrific program.
Yeah, and Leslie Kendall, thanks so much for letting us in your museum here. It's just awesome.
John, thanks so much for having me. Thanks for coming, and I want to echo John's sentiments. It's
well,
wonderful
we gotta
to be on your show.
Because, you know, we didn't even hit the highlights. I mean, we barely skimmed them. There's so much more to see in this
museum.
There's
an awful lot more to see, and anybody can see it any time, corner Wilshire and Fairfax, fairfaxpeterson.org.
Right.
And remember, no O in Peterson.
Yeah.
E-N.
There you go. Well, time for me to wrap this up here, folks. But remember, you can always catch the show at autoline.tv. You can always follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/autoline. Remember, check out Peter DeLorenzo's Auto Extremist column at autoextremist.com. All his rants and everything else he covers there at twitter.com/autoextremist. And he, like us, is also available on Facebook. You can check it all out there. But thanks so much for having joined us. It's great to be in LA and going through this museum with two hardcore car guys.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at autoline.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.